or unnaturally dry skin, like the blood drinkers, the glowering mien of the Red Knights, the bright white hair of the Red Wings, and the pronounced eye teeth of the Charnel Guard. Goss had skin so white, his veins were a map of blue rivers. Balthus was unusually ruddy, his angelic features coarse. Lord Folodark was on the dais with Dante. Unlike their men, the chapter masters wore their power armor, all of it burnished to a gleaming shine. "How can they celebrate on the eve of battle?" said Goss. "What would your chapter do, Brother Goss?" said Irwin. "Stand vigil," said Goss. "In silence." "Well, I prefer to drink," said Balthus, and raised his goblet. The evening passed in similar exchanges. Irwin spoke with these two and the captains a few seats down from him on either side. The officers had been mixed to sit with those of other chapters, and Irwin's nearest chapter brother was 10 seats away. Irwin had an open mind. He welcomed the opportunity to meet others. He had the feeling that Goss did not feel the same way. Once he caught Asante staring at him. He was sitting so that he was just visible to Irwin, where the table bent around and the captains further on were hidden by the chapter master's dais. Irwin nodded at him. The fleet captain looked away. Dante kept a good table. 9 courses were served in honor of the old legion's number. The wine kept flowing, so much of it that Irwin began to feel its effect as the night wore on. Finally, the last plates were cleared away, and the chapters each nominated one of their number to recite a poem of their deeds or to sing of glorious days. Among the chapters who shared the Blood Angel's fondness for art, there were many fine lyricists. Some of the chapters of the Blood looked disdainfully on, for their control stemmed from self-denial and the scourging of the flesh. Goss, in particular, appeared dismayed at such frivolity. Others yet had darker ways of managing the thirst. Throughout, Dante sat quietly. He did not remove his helmet or partake of any drink or meat. When the final lay had been recited, and all the trumpets and lyres set aside, Dante stood. "Now we shall end our evening, my brothers, in displays of martial skill," said the commander. "Who will duel first in the Ring of Heaven?" There set up an enormous clamour to claim the honour. 100 stood from their tables and shouted out their names. Irwin saw Asante make his way up to the dais and attract his lord's attention. Dante held up his hand. The room fell silent. The commander's rich voice filled the well of angels. "I beg your indulgence, brothers of the Blood. My brother Asante, captain of our battle barge, the Blade of Vengeance, requests that he be permitted to issue the first challenge. Do any here object?" A resounding cheer answered the question. "Very well," said Dante. "Whom do you challenge, Captain Asante?" Asante walked around the base of the dais until he stood face to face with Irwin. He stared, stony-faced.
"I challenge Captain Irwin of the Angels Excelsis."
Irwin stood.
"Do you accept, Captain Irwin?" asked Dante.
Irwin smiled widely.
"Of course," he said, and drained his wine.
By mutual agreement and effort, the tables around the Ring of Heaven were removed. When space had been cleared to hold a crowd, some space marines headed up into the lushness of the Verdis Elysia, whose multiple levels and uneven slopes offered better vantage points to watch the coming duel. Asante walked through a metal gate held open by a human serf and down steps coiled around the arena wall to the sandy floor. Irwin followed. Space marines crowded the edge of the arena as they descended. Asante paced, shucking off his robe to stand in soft trousers and heavy boots. His pale chest was massive with muscle. A big scar ran diagonally from top left to bottom right, a light grey track over the darkness of the black carapace under his skin. His body servant scooped up the robe and took it away. Irwin took off his own outer robe with more care. Underneath, he wore a light vest. He was surprised how angry Asante appeared. The Blood Angels were supposed to be among the calmer of Sanguinius's progeny, but compared to Irwin's own chapter, Asante was short-tempered. A gate opened. Servitors entered, carrying racks of melee weapons. Under the direction of red-robed blood thralls, they set them up at the side of the arena. Fine craftsmanship was the hallmark of each. All were edged, but none were powered.
"I offer the challenge. What weapon will you select?" said Asante.
Irwin shrugged.
"Your challenge? Your choice, Captain."
"Longswords,"
said Asante. He spoke through bared teeth. His jaw hardly moved as he spoke.
Long swords it is, then, said Irwin.
He beckoned a serf, who fetched a straight sword 4 feet long. An identical weapon was brought from a second rack. The mortals who carried them were obliged to use all their strength, but Asante and Irwin took the hilts in a single hand. Irwin gave his weapon a few experimental sweeps. It hissed through the air.
Barlight steel, Irwin said, impressed.
He ran his finger down the blade.
Sharp.
Asante glowered at him. A tall pulpit was wheeled to the edge of the pit. The platform was faced on all sides by the visage of stern angels, whose foreheads bore massive bloodstones. Dante mounted the steps, and the pulpit was pushed out further as he ascended, until it was over the edge of the pit. From there, he could address combatants and audience both.
"For what reason is this challenge issued?" said Commander Dante. "In amity or in enmity?"
"Enmity. This is a matter of honor. Captain Irwin jeopardized my mission at Zozan with his disregard for my orders," said Asante scornfully.
"What is your response, Captain Irwin?" asked Dante. "I've given my response already," said Irwin, altogether more mildly. "I was under no obligation to obey him. I came to his aid, whereupon he immediately assumed he was my superior. I declined to agree. By following my own course, as is my right, I saved a ship of the Angel's Numinous he had set as a decoy from destruction."
Dante's impassive, masked face stared down.
"There is no grudge here," said Dante. "You may step aside from the challenge if you wish, Captain Irwin."
"Oh, no," said Irwin with a sly smile. "I do not want that at all. I will fight Asante for the pleasure of it, if there is no matter of honor to answer."
"With no malice," said Dante, "from either side."
Asante shook his head.
"Honor, not malice."
"None whatsoever, my lord," said Irwin.
"Then take your places," said Dante. "This bout shall go no further than the point of yielding. Blood may be spilt, but if I deem there is a serious risk to either combatant, I shall call a halt myself. Is this understood?"
"Aye, my lord," said Asante.
"Yes," said Irwin.
Irwin and Asante went to opposite sides of the dueling ring, 50 feet apart.
"Then stand ready," commanded Dante.
They raised their blades in mirror image, two hands on the long hilts, tips pointed directly upward.
"Begin," said Dante.
Silence fell upon the gathering. Asante and Irwin circled each other, 1 foot over another in measured sidesteps. They spiraled inward until they were within striking distance, eyes locked, each waiting for the other to move. Captain Asante broke first, his blade flicking out towards Irwin's head as he stepped in. Irwin parried easily and deflected the attack that followed. The blades sang off each other, and then they were back in their guard positions, swords humming with the impact. Asante attempted two more such attacks, seeking to draw responses from Irwin so that he might decipher his fighting style and construct a strategy to beat him. Irwin kept his responses to a minimum, giving nothing away. Asante was stronger than Irwin, and more aggressive. Irwin reckoned himself the better swordsman. Asante's attacks lacked finesse. In case it were bluff, and he was hiding his skill, he reserved forming an opinion. Eventually, Irwin decided it was his time to strike, his sword flashing out and taking Asante by surprise. Three attempts around Asante's guard were foiled. Their blades spoke for them in quick, metallic sentences. They parted a moment, drawing a few paces further back from one another. Their circling slowed, and then the fight began in earnest. Irwin attacked without warning, his sword directed low for Asante's legs. The Blood Angel saw the move and responded. Irwin switched line before Asante's counter could land. Asante leapt back too slowly, and Irwin's blade drew a line of crimson across Asante's ribs.
"Do you yield?" said Irwin.
Asante showed his teeth. His eyes were shining, his canines long. The thirst had him.
Irwin's own thirst rose in response.
It surprised Irwin that Asante's anger affected him. They were not of the same brotherhood. Asante's wound was shallow and closed quickly. They attacked together, swords weaving blurs of steel around their heads, blades sparking when they hit. Asante sought to shake Irwin's grip with his superior strength, but Irwin was too practiced. Asante backed away.
Irwin, his blood up, came forward, but Asante's retreat had been a false one, and he powered off his back leg, sword swinging around for a powerful blow. Captain Irwin's blade rang heavily from Captain Asante's. Asante barged into him, and they both staggered back. Irwin was too slow in bringing his blade back into position, and Asante slammed the crossguard of his sword into Irwin's face. Irwin turned his head a fraction of a second before the Quillian could take his eye. Asante's fist met his mouth instead. Lips burst on his teeth, filling his mouth briefly with blood, before his enhanced physiology sealed the wound. Asante dropped back and swung the blade around at head height. Again, in the nick of time, Irwin parried, but he was off balance and it was a clumsy interception. Asante came in again, weapon blurring. He ducked a desperate blow from Irwin by dropping into a crouch, swinging his legs around to take Irwin's out from underneath him. Before Irwin could stand, Asante was over him, sword at his neck.
"Yield," said Asante.
"I will yield," said Irwin, and spat a thick clot of blood from his mouth.
Asante cast aside his sword and reached out his hand. Irwin took it.
"Let all enmity be banished," said Dante, "worked out in this argument of swords. Is your enmity banished, Captain Irwin?"
"I had none to begin with, my lord," said Irwin.
"And you, Brother Asante," said Dante.
"Will you obey me in future?"
said Asante. He held out his hand again. Irwin looked at it, then up at Asante's face.
"I told you if my chapter master decreed I should follow you, then I would. He has, so I shall."
He reached out his hand, and he and Asante clasped wrists.
"Your beating me has nothing to do with it," said Irwin.
"Maybe not," said Asante, lightly panting, "but I still beat you."
Irwin laughed. They were walking from the ring when the next call for challenges went out. This, however, was interrupted by the loud trumpet of a herald servitor.
"My lords, pray welcome Captain Fenn of the Angels Vermilion."
Dante froze. Irwin thought that a strange reaction, and he stopped at the edge of the pit to watch. Asante halted by him. He stared in open hostility at the newcomers, and this, too, Irwin found curious. Over 100 warriors came into the Well of Angels through a gateway tunnel bored through the Verdis Elysia and out of the northern cliff. They were arrayed for battle, and their armor was scarred with signs of recent combat. Several of them were wounded. Acid had burned away their paint, leaving bare discolored metal in place of their livery. Enough of them carried colors so that their chapter could be identified. The gathered blood of Sanguinius parted to let them through. Their feet crashed on stone as they marched in close formation to stand before Dante, unchallenged. Their leaders came forward in a loose group, a captain, a chaplain, and 3 sanguinary priests. Their leader held up his hand, and the party knelt and dropped their heads, the wounded among them performing the same action, though it clearly pained them to do so. When they were all on their knees, the captain joined them. Only then did he speak.
"I am Captain Fenn," said their leader. "I come to treat with Commander Dante, Lord of the Host. We have travelled far to offer fealty to the Lord of Baal and to aid in the coming battle."
"What is the meaning of this?"
said Dante, fury thickening his voice. Captain Fenn kept his head bowed.
"We offer ourselves for the defence in the name of Sanguinius and of the Blood, as is our right as scions of the Great Angel. Although we were not called upon, we are here."
A chaplain pushed his way to the front of the crowd.
"I am Chaplain Ordermail, and I say you are not welcome here," he said.
"Brother, what is happening?"
said Irwin to Asante. Asante glanced at Irwin in puzzlement. Perhaps he expected Irwin to bear a grudge against him. Irwin widened his eyes to prompt a response.
"Dante issued a ban on the Angels Vermilion some 500 years ago," said Asante reluctantly. "He will not say why. Only the High Chaplain knows."
"The Paternus Sanguis speaks the truth. You are not welcome here," said Dante.
"Aid is not welcome. I bring more than 100 warriors," said Fenn.
"We do not need your help," said Dante.
Fenn looked up.
"Nevertheless, we are here. Do not turn us away."
Sanguinius's metal face glowered down from the pulpit. Fenn got to his feet and removed his helmet. He was young for a captain and afflicted with journey's weariness, but he would have his say.
"My lord, I am aware of your dislike for our chapter," he said.
We have braved many dangers in our voyage from the Bloodspike to Baal. The warp is in turmoil. Tyranids infest every system we attempted to put into. As you can see, we have fought our way here, losing 2/3 of our number on our pilgrimage. Chapter Master Child cannot buy his forgiveness by your sacrifice, said Dante. Forgive me, my lord, but Chapter Master Child is dead, slain by the Necrons 40 years ago. Moar is master of our brotherhood now. He does not know we're here, and indeed we have come in direct contravention of his orders. We humbly ask for your absolution for the sins of our chapter. Not for ourselves, but so that we might protect the home of our gene-sire by your side.
Murmurs ran around the crowd. It appeared few warriors knew of Dante's distaste for the angel's vermilion.
You will renounce your practices, said Dante, the letting of innocent blood. Which chapter can claim their hands are clean of innocent blood? Said Fenn. All of us know brothers who have fallen. Your Tower of Amario holds its own secrets. How are they who are held within fed?
Dante evaded the question.
Your kind institutionalized butchery, he said. Rationally. Coldly. Only to prevent worse atrocity, said Fenn. Our chapter is not the only one to sate its appetites this way. For the loss of a few, the many are protected.
Outraged shouts greeted this last pronouncement.
You are in no position to allege misdeeds on the parts of others when yours are known, said Dante.
Fenn was disappointed.
For our honesty we are punished. Lesser men would become your enemies, not beg to be your friends. We here do not agree with our chapter practices. They have grown more extreme under Moa. We wish only to serve as best we may. We will place ourselves at the vanguard of the fighting. Let our deaths redeem us.
Dante regarded the captain for a moment.
You are sincere in your desire for rapprochement? Absolutely. Tell me what occurred on your voyage here.
There were nigh 3 companies of us, said Fenn. We 50 and 12 are all to remain. We were to rendezvous with brothers of the 5th company at Danbin. Their captain is close to me, a friend, and shares my opinions of Moa. There was no sign of them. Instead, we were welcomed by the foe. We were attacked there by a tyrannid swarm and forced to fight ourselves free and back into the warp. Away from the shadow, we attempted to send an in-warp message to our brothers, trusting that they, too, had fought past the tyrannids. We made brief contact, but lost 2 of our 3 astropaths to the shadow madness for our efforts, and so we broke warp at Aldine to attempt communication again. We were ambushed as soon as we emerged. The tyrannids were waiting for us, as if they knew we would arrive. We lost 2 cruisers, Captain Malfeyan and the majority of our 3rd company. Their gene seed has gone. Once more we were forced to withdraw. Within the immaterium we found ourselves half-blind. A darkness is falling over the Astronomicon. The shadow of the warp laps at the shores of this system. I fear we are the last to answer the call of the gathering host. The tyrannids are coming.
A murmur went around the room.
It could be so. Aldine is close to Baal, said Bellerophon rapidly.
Dante silenced him.
We thought it would be safe, said Fenn. We were wrong.
We are sorry for your losses, said Dante.
Fenn took the condolences well.
We are sorry we could bring no more of our brothers to aid you, my lord. If your judgment goes against us, we could fight my brothers and the host here. We will not. If you desire to kill us, we will not resist. We come to Baal in its time of need. Will you put aside your hatred of our chapter for the moment and accept?
Dante paused. He gripped the sides of his pulpit and bowed his head. Erwin was surprised yet again. Dante was a legend. Legends do not hesitate. Abruptly, Dante raised his head. Light flashed from Sanguinius's angry face.
Rise, my brothers, said Dante.
The angel's vermilion stood.
I accept the terms of your service. You are welcome to fight with us in memory of our progenitor. Sit now. Feast. You deserve your rest before the real struggle begins.
My lord!
Protested Ordemail.
My decision is made, chaplain. If Moa himself came here, my reaction would have been different.
These warriors are penitents. Thralls came to the Angel's Vermilion and led them to seats. Food was brought out for them. Human medicae and sanguinary priests from several chapters went to the aid of the wounded. Tech marines tended their machines. Relief passed over Fenn's exhausted face.
My thanks, my lord.
Now, called Dante, we shall continue. Who will bring the next challenge?
Chapter 13. The Taking of the Innocents. Bronze doors clanked open, and Commander Dante stepped out onto the marble pediment of the statue of Sanguinius. The sanguinary guard and blood thralls lining the balustrade saluted. The tense hush of a silent crowd greeted him, their breath a gentle breeze on the still air. There were several thousand barlights crammed into the square. Tens of thousands more waited outside the city walls of Angel's Fall. Dante surveyed them, and they turned their faces away in fear when the blank stare of Sanguinius's death mask met their eyes. 1500 years ago he had stood in that same square with the crowds, looking up at the statue and the living angels at its feet. Was there any of that boy left inside him, he wondered. Millennia had dulled his memories of the days before. Sanguinius's gene seed had wiped away the face he had once had. Time had eroded the new one that replaced it. Only his eyes, tawny amber, and possessed of a confliction of warmth and cold, remained the same. Everything else had changed. Everything.
People of Baal, he said, and all over Baal Secundus his words were repeated, translated where necessary into tribal pidgin. A host of imperfect angels, effigies of hololithic light 400 feet tall, came to life all over the twin moons. The nearest wavered ghost-like outside the city, projection ribbons shimmering where they encountered pockets of static-laden dust in the air, the loop patterning barely strong enough to be seen through the sun. At Kemrenda and Selltown, at Angel's Leap and in the Ghostlands, at the gathering of clans in the Great Salt Waste, and at every other place on the moon where the sparse population gathered in any number, Dante spoke. He had considered carefully how to deliver his edict. It had to be done simultaneously on both worlds. He had to do it in person, but he could only be in one place at a time. He was not biased in choosing his one-time home. He told himself Baal Secundus was the more populous. It had Angel's Fall. It had the more viable ecosystem. The Tyranids would hit Secundus harder than Primus. Still, he felt a pang of guilt to favor one moon over the other, even so slightly. Under my rule, he continued, these worlds have seen many dangers and faced many threats. We have repelled them, whether orc or traitor. You have prospered while my angels have protected you. Your young have bolstered our ranks, taking up the onerous service of the great angel for the glory of the Imperium of Man. Baal and its moons have contributed more than many other worlds to the survival of our species, and for that I am thankful. The Emperor is thankful. A worshipful moan passed over the crowd. Dante's words echoed down every street of the shanty capital of Baal Secundus. Where the titanic hololiths could not be seen, servo skulls and herald cherubs drifted over deserted sands, shouting out the message to the wind and the fire scorpions. In these dark times, we face our greatest challenge yet. A horde of alien monsters bears down upon our system. Already, they have devoured much of the life of the Red Scar Suns. Our worlds are next. I will not allow the birth world of the Great Angel to fall, nor shall Baal Primus or Baal itself. You see in the skies the gathered might of all Sanguinius's sons. I called them, and they heeded. They are here to stop this terror on these sands, where once our blessed father trod. The fearful silence was broken by the rumble of engines. A pair of giant cargo landers grumbled overhead. The crowd started at them, as if they were the vanguard of invasion. I must ask more of you than I have ever asked before. And here was the final message, which would condemn so many. Dante hid his sorrow to deliver their fate in the same bombastic fashion.
those of you capable of carrying weapons will be deployed under the command of the angels to aid in the defense of Baal. These ships, you see, carry guns and ammunition. Every man and woman of sound body over the age of 10 standard Terran years will be armed. Children below the age of 10 and their mothers will be excused this duty and evacuated from the system today. Weeks of rumors had sent the population into a state of dread anticipation. Their worst fears confirmed, their dread turned into panic. Dante raised his voice. Any refusing this duty shall be executed. All must fight, or all will perish. This is my decree as commander of the Blood Angels, Chapter Master, Lord of Baal, Baal Primus, Baal Secundus, and of the Angelic Host. The crowd surged forward. Those at the front, until moments ago full of quiet adoration, were crushed up against the marble. Outside the walls, rockets thundered as the cargo lifters touched down. Loading ramps dropped, and transit containers rolled out from their holds, each one full of lasguns. May the Emperor watch over you and protect you. May we all find mercy in his light. Blood thralls were moving into the crowd, heavily armed and armored. They shoved at the people, corralling sections of the populace and herding them away for processing under the watchful eyes of space marines. Feeble fists thumped off their carapace armor. The Baalites were screaming, shouting, weeping and wailing. Questions issued from a thousand mouths, merging into a harsh babble that could never be answered.
"Stay back!" roared the sanguinary guard. "Away from the statue of Sanguinius! Away!"
Dante turned and marched back within the pediment. Inside was a small complex, completely unknown to the men and women living above it. A fast monotrack waited to take him to the Fortress of the Blood at the edge of the city, where a thunderhawk stood by. The first shots rang out before the bronze doors sealed themselves with a doomy thump, cutting out the screams of a panicking multitude. The Blood Angels were not gentle in this recruitment. Resistance was brutally quashed, and the square was soon sticky with spilled blood. Similar scenes were repeated all over both moons. Dante hated himself for what he was doing, but it was necessary. The guns were needed in Baal's defense, but more was at stake. The more human biomass he could remove from each of the moons, the more likely the moons were to survive. He must drive the Tyranids to attack the Arx Angelicum directly. He was counting on it. Seeing the necessity and stomaching the manner of its execution were two different matters. To ensure the survival of his chapter, he had exterminated worlds, and now he brutalized his own people. To billions, Commander Dante was a hero. For centuries he had striven to be worthy of their love. He felt far from heroic at that moment. He betrayed himself by fulfilling his duty. He hardened his heart. Worse was to come. Far above the complex where Dante walked, over the square where the protectors turned on the protected, the serene face of Sanguinius's giant statue stared heavenward, away from the violence perpetrated in his name. Dante held court upon the Blade of Vengeance. Chapter masters came from both worlds in flocks of transports to the gathering. It was a pre-mission edification like no other. There had been precious few gatherings of so many space marine lords in all the history of the Imperium, fewer still of all one bloodline, and only a handful of similar size at Baal itself. They arrived shorn of pomp, for the time of display was done. Space marines were warriors first and foremost, and although ceremony had its place in all they did, when battle came, they were sober and focused. The decision to follow Dante was made. There were no sly words in deserted corridors, no jockeying for power one would find in another Imperial force. Space marines were weapons clothed in men's flesh. They willingly put themselves at Dante's disposal. 17 chapter masters, their aides and a dozen other officers who led chapter contingents where the master was not present, sat within the red council chamber on the flagship. 6 more stood behind the chairs as luminous hololith ghosts. Dante was humbled by their loyalty to Sanguinius. He was under no illusion. He knew full well that when they looked to him for leadership, it was not Dante they saw, but Sanguinius's eternal golden visage. Time turns about a spiral, he thought, in silent prayer. We live in a pale reflection of ancient times. Here we are but a shadow of you and your legion, great angel. Give me the strength through your blood to honor you.
My lords, said Dante, the time has come.
He held up a hand. A vox recording crackled out of concealed speakers.
Heir of Destiny, report 32, mission 309, other Sergeant Callisto reporting.
The recording was a mess, cut up by sequenced interference pulses, but the enemy had not completely succeeded in blotting it out.
Position Dernos 5.
The recording became stronger.
High Fleet Leviathan is here. Tell the commander that there are millions of them. We cannot achieve an accurate count.
Shouting came from the background, calls for signal boost and shield activation. The recording cut out, becoming a buzzsaw drone. Signal beeps punched through the racket. When Callisto's voice returned, it was blurred and came with a rumble of weapons fire.
Are engaged. We are surrounded. I repeat, we cannot retreat. We...
A cry and an explosion cut short the recording.
Chapter Master Tekiel, said Dante.
The Lord of the Disciples of Blood stood from his chair. He had no helmet on. The mass of scar tissue he had for a face twisted his mouth into a permanent snarl.
This message was received by the Red Blade, also of my chapter. The Spear of Destiny was on the far side of the Adernos system when the Tyranids emerged from the system fringe. They were lost. The Red Blade made warp and returned. Their auger soundings speak of a swarm of unprecedented size.
Captain Fenn encountered them at Aldine, said Dante. A cartolith quivered into focus over the hollow circular table. Baal was at the center. Other Red Scar systems around it. A star blinked.
From Aldine, it is 3.4 light-years to Adonos. The Tyranids are making great speed towards us.
We can be thankful they do not travel the warp,
growled Malthas of the Exsanguinators.
If they did, then we would be dead.
Even so, they make a mockery of natural law in moving so quickly,
said Zargo of the Angels in Carmine.
Their ships are slow in system. But in the interstellar void, we have nothing that can match them. We need more time.
We have a few similar eyewitness accounts from other systems, said Dante, and our scourging fleets have encountered scouting swarms at 6 others. Astropathic plea prayers were received from 9 more.
A crescent of minor stars blinked, then 12 once populous star systems within the same vector. All of them were lifeless now, made so by Tyranid consumption or at Dante's order.
They approach on a broad front, said Dante. So far as we can tell, all from the galactic south. This gives us an advantage. Thus far, we have denied them the opportunity to replenish their fleet biomass from the Red Scar systems. Therefore, the combined might of the fleets will not be much over what our intelligence suggests. Our defenses are ready. The concentration of our forces and of the drafted populations around the Arx Angelicum should ensure that the full force of the Tyranid attack falls there, where we are strongest, and not on the moons.
Dante pressed his hands flat on the table.
These are only small consolations. Let it be known that we face the greatest concentration of Tyranids since High Fleet Behemoth penetrated Ultramar.
He paused.
The shadow is falling. Our astropathic prayers no longer resist the roar of the hive mind. The warp is becalmed all around the system. Its currents are stilling as water upon which oil is poured. There will be no more reinforcements. My requests to my brothers at Diamor go unanswered. There will be no more messages. The great devourer approaches.
Sanguinius's face looked at each of the chapter masters in turn.
They are coming.
Chapter 14. Broken Necklace. The Junker tribesman, Chrismsay, led Gabriel Seth over rusty plains. He scurried, he scuttled, he did not walk like a true man. Seth's steady, heavy footsteps crunched upon the crusted surface of ancient war glass, while Chrismsay's pattered, rodent-like, and furtive. The Junker was young, though reckoned old for his tribe. Sparely muscled, his growth stunted by malnutrition, teeth already rotting in his head. Seth fought down his contempt for the youth. He had been useful during the fortification of Baal Primus. He had shown Seth the ancient redoubts on the shoulders of the moon's wrecked orbitals that his men now labor to rebuild. Chrisimsay's knowledge of the deep caverns of the necklace was invaluable, and he had a certain wiliness. But he was not sufficiently gifted to be a candidate for apotheosis, or he would not be languishing on the moon. Chrisimsay was evasive when questioned about the Blood Angel's trial. Seth thought he must have tried. Anyone living in a hellhole like Baal Primus would try. Now there was this, a report of another force of space marines putting down on the far side of the necklace that had been corroborated by no other source, and that Chrisimsay would show to no one but Seth. Perhaps the youth meant to lead him into a trap. He was a greater fool than he looked, if that were so. Oxide dust puffed up with every footstep. The area around the necklace was thick with metal rusted to powder over the glass. The glass was a product of firestorms from reactor failure when the orbitals came down. Seth suspected the necklace had been bombed after their fall also. The ancients must have possessed terrible weapons, for there were areas still hot with exotic isotopes 12,000 years after the supposed date of the war. Imperial atomics would render an area dangerously radioactive for weeks, not years, never mind millennia. Whoever had attacked Baal Primus had been engaged in a calculated attempt at sterilization. Such hate between the two worlds, humanity's capacity for hatred was bottomless. If indeed the legends were true and the wreck of the Paradise Moons had not been occasioned by Xenos' assault, the ancient attempt at exterminatus had failed. Humanity was a persistent vermin species that thrived in wreckage. Mankind had survived on Baal Primus to produce such debased specimens as Chrisimsay. The boy turned back to him, yellowed eyes peering over hunched shoulders. His head was covered over by the filthy pelt of a creature native to the deeps of the necklace, possibly descended from Terran rats.
"We must go up, Angel, to the top,"
Chrisimsay pointed to the square wall of the unnatural mountains.
"Other ones on the far side."
"My warriors saw nothing," said Seth. "This system is full of other chapters. They saw nothing. I do not believe you."
Chrisimsay shrugged nonchalantly.
"Chrisimsay not lying, he not knowing, but Chrisimsay sees. You see too, if you follow me."
"If you are lying, I will kill you," said Seth.
Seth's voxbeed pinged. Chaplain Apollos's voice followed.
"Seth, these wretches are pitiful. They will not work hard enough."
Apollos's perpetually angry voice barked in Seth's ear.
"The Eastern Fortress will not be ready by the estimated time of planetfall."
"Why are you telling me this?" growled Seth. "Work them harder."
"You should be here to tell them yourself," spat the chaplain. "I invoke the rights of my rank to reprimand you. You neglect your duties."
Seth thought this hypocritical, coming from Apollos, whose own penchant for violence often had him rushing ahead of his brothers into adventures of his own with little thought for the consequences.
"You will hold your tongue, Master of the Lost. You will oversee the construction while I am gone, and you are not to provide your usual brand of incentive. We need the mortals."
"Then how am I to make them work?"
"Use your imagination. You have grown soft, Seth."
"Insult me again, Apollos. I dare you," said Seth. "Perform your duty. Finish the fortress. I will be back soon."
He cut the box. Chrisimsay stared expectantly at his giant charge, chewing on ragged nails as he waited. Seth nodded at him. Chrisimsay grinned and scurried off, but no matter how fast his legs rose and fell, he could not outpace Seth's slow, deliberate stride. Time had worn down the wounds of the long-ago war. Edges of minor impact craters overlaid on one another had been abraded down to soft circles so that the earth was pocked like the skin of a survivor of disease. Wiry vegetation covered over irregular highlands. The orbitals had come down in a long line, and at first glance they appeared a natural mountain range. Shock ridges wrinkled the plains for dozens of miles around them, the stone blending with the metal of the fallen orbitals in a facsimile of foothills. Erosion had smoothed off snapped spars and caused decks to collapse, sealing the hollow interiors away from sight. Only after a time examining them did the mountain's true nature reveal itself. It was there to see, in the boxy strata of compressed decks, the strangely straight courses of mountain streams in the square mouths of room caves until they crested the last ridge, and there came a point where the broken orbital plate rose suddenly from the ravaged crust around it in an unnatural cliff. There, the beginning of man's artifice was sharply delineated. Seth rested his hand on ancient metal and looked upward.
"Now we climb, yes? Yes!" shouted Chrisomsay
eagerly. He beckoned to the Space Marine Lord that he follow into a ragged cave mouth. Seth looked back. Crags of stone, pushed up by ancient impact, blocked his view of the way back to the fortification site. His presence would not finish the forts any quicker, no matter what Apollos said. Shaking off his misgivings, he ducked into the cave and passed through the flaking hull of the ancient orbital of Baal. They avoided the deep caverns, skirting through the outer passages to make their way to the summits. The route had been improved by generations of Chrisomsay's people, though in the most rudimentary way. Bridges of sheet metal crossed holes in the floor. Rents in buckled walls and decks had been widened into doors. Rope railings had been strung alongside the most dangerous drops. The work was crude, like the war rigs the Junkers rode around on the plains beyond the False Mountains. There were chasms that could have been crossed by slightly more advanced engineering, but that appeared to be beyond the Junkers. Any culture that could maintain combustion engines should be able to make a proper bridge, but the Junkers could not. The desperate nature of their existence had pruned away any knowledge that was not absolutely essential to their survival. The outer passages opened in many places to the outside world. Seth's enhanced mind, so much more powerful than Chrisomsay's, kept track of their path easily, confounding Chrisomsay's attempts to conceal the route. They passed a small, rust-red waterfall, gurgling from on high, disappearing down a chute into metallic deeps. Ferric deposits furred the walls, narrowing the passageway. They crossed a bridge, little more than a plank of metal, that shook dangerously under Seth's weight. On the far side, half hidden by the accretions of rust, there was a doorway.
"That way is quicker," said Seth.
Chrisomsay did not ask how Seth could possibly know such a thing. Seth was an angel. He knew things nobody else did.
"No, no, my lord. Dangerous. Phantoms and ghasts, and worse are there. We go upward."
The boy's fear of the deeps was greater than that he had of Seth, and he hurried on ahead before Seth could command otherwise. Seth looked down the dark hallway. His space marine eyes saw a space still recognizable as a maintenance corridor. Drifts of detritus cluttered the corners, and its bulkheads were bent out of true. But this part of the ancient space station had come down belly first, and it was more or less level. A dank wind blew from somewhere far inside. Seth grunted and followed the boy. They stayed within the orbital for a short time. Soon after waterfall, the path emerged through a bent-toothed docking gate, and they continued their ascent through a wood of stunted trees whose limbs bore witness to genetic corruption. That part of the station had sustained heavy damage. Its hull was crumpled, giving chance for thin soils to accumulate. In places, it was possible to forget the origin of the mountains until a square and deadly shaft yawned suddenly underfoot, or the armored glass of an ancient viewing port glinted from behind curtains of orange mosses. On they went, following ancestral trails of Chrisomsay's people. The Junkers had no vehicles that could traverse this terrain. All was tailored to hiking. Where the trail grew steep, there were ropes and ladders, or badly welded steps, to speed them on. These additions were few, for the orientation of the downed orbital and its broken nature made for easy climbing. In a few hours, they had walked several miles from the Flesh Tearer's fortifications and ascended 1,700 feet. Smashed turrets and spires made the peaks of the artificial range. Their dull grey metals were cloaked in ice, for though the altitude was modest, Baal Primus was a cold world. Dirty snow, the product of Baal Primus's dysfunctional hydrological cycle, crunched underfoot. By now, Seth could hear the newcomers. The sky rumbled softly to the coming and going of landing craft. Chrisomsay led him over the shoulder of a massive habitation section. Dark holes of glassless viewports were glazed with rippled yellow ice. Chrisomsay's clothing was hardly adequate for the lowlands, and up on the mountain top he was blue with cold. His teeth chattered, and he jammed his hands into his armpits periodically to warm them. And yet he did not appear to notice the gravity of his suffering. Seth supposed the boy had never been truly warm.
"Down there,"
Chrisomsay pointed to a shelf at the top of a cliff.
"The others."
Seth trudged down to the cliff edge. His armored boots broke ancient ice, and he half skidded, coming to a swaying stop at the brink of the cliff. The far side of the orbital was a shattered mess. A scrubby forest clung to the exposed internal structure, cloaking it in vegetation. Over time, deep fields had formed in hollows, and taller trees grew from them. This relative verdancy gave out once more at the beginning of the plains. Baal Primus's erratic rains fell only on the higher ground. Beyond was a cold badland of crevices and razored ridges, made in that moment 12,000 years ago, when the orbital had plunged from the sky and turned paradise into hell. It had changed little since. Some miles out, the shock ridges spread, allowing for wide depressions between. In one of them, a small army mustered, their transports roaring up into space and back again. Seth's face pulled tight. Centuries of mishaps had led him to isolate his warriors from his allies. When the flesh terrors were in battle, they were at the mercy of the Red first. Sanguinius's dubious legacy gave them the strength to overcome enemies of far greater numbers, but if the first were not appeased, their allies or civilians paid the price. His predecessors had been less scrupulous than Seth, or perhaps more cursed. Near excommunication had been the result, and with it the discovery of the flaw in Sanguinius's gene seed that would have endangered all the chapters of the blood. He did not like to fight alongside others. He had deliberately positioned his force away from the three other chapters sent by Dante to protect Baal Primus. And now, here was a fifth chapter who dared to establish themselves on his doorstep. He called upon the talents of his armor to discover who the interlopers were. A glint in the sky grew instantly in his vision, magnified by his helm lenses, until it became a Thunderhawk gunship with a battered livery of dark red and silver. Only one chapter bore those colors, a chapter that had a reputation for frenzied savagery that exceeded that of his own brotherhood. "The Knights of Blood," he said. The newcomers were still arriving by Thunderhawk, an unarmored lighter. The ships touched down without shutting off their engines, returning to orbit to shuttle down more. 20 Thunderhawk flights was all it had taken to bring the flesh terrors down to Baal Primus from the battle barge Victus. There were so few of them left. Even that had taken too long, for Seth's armory was almost as empty as his barracks. The spirits of his war machines were bloodthirsty like their masters, and the vehicles were apt to make rash, aggressive moves that too often resulted in their loss. The Knights of Blood had the edge in numbers of men and machines. If what he heard was true of them, they would not likely withdraw. He towed the snow, watched it crunch and fritter to pieces that tumbled from the edge. Dante did this on purpose, he thought. He fought back his anger and called up to Chrisomsay, huddled out of the wind in the lee of a communication spine poking up from the snow. "How long to their landing site?"
"A half day, my lord."
Half a day. For all his complaints, Apollos would have things under control at the fortress. He trusted Codicea Belfiel to keep him in line. This could not wait.
"Take me there now," said Seth.
As Seth approached the landing zone of the Knights of Blood, he saw that they did not intend to stay there. No castella or other temporary defenses had been established. Instead, transports waited in column to take them away. He could see no warriors, assuming them to be within their land raiders and rhinos. The Knights of Blood were close to moving out. It was a foolish hope to expect them to go further away. He knew in the pit of his stomach they intended to make for his own position. Baal passed in front of the sun, bringing on the first of Baal Primus's two long nights. Nothing was simple in the Baal system, not even night and day. The Blood Angels were the same, with their art and their denial. He embraced his savagery. Simplicity was the key to holding the first at bay. He had no time for games. The equipment of the Knights of Blood was as battered and spattered with old blood as that of his own chapter. The vehicle insignia followed Codex Astartes norms, and from that he saw that this was an ad hoc formation made of units drawn from across the chapter. Several years ago, the Knights of Blood had declared a crusade against all the enemies of the Imperium, but so savage was their campaigning, and so broad their definition of an enemy, that they had been declared renegades by the High Lords of Terra themselves. Before then, they had been like the Flesh Terrors, looked upon warily by their allies. Now, they were friendless and persecuted, though they protested that they were still loyal to the Imperium. Another force, close to extinction. Though they had gone further down the road of damnation than Seth and his warriors, it was only chance their positions were not reversed. Stepping into their landing zone brought him closer to their fate, and he did so warily. The Knights of Blood brought no supplies with them, only fighting vehicles. Empty ammunition crates littered the sand left where they'd been thrown open. The dust was churned up. Sheets of it floated slowly on the breeze, final flags to wave off the departed Thunderhawks. All about was a sense of disarray, though the material scattered around was modest. Few Space Marine chapters would be this careless in deployment. The tanks, however, evinced order. They stood silently in the desert. Wind moaned through their fittings. "Remain here," said Seth to Chrismsay 100 yards out from the line of tanks. The scrawny youth shook his head emphatically. He unslung his makeshift firearm and slipped into Seth's shadow. "Stop!" A metallic voice rang out from the land raider heading the column. Its engine burst riotously into life. Lights snapped on, grinding tracks spun on the spot. With servos purring, the land raider brought all of its considerable weaponry to bear on the chaptermaster. "State your name," demanded the metallic voice. "State your business."
"You know who I am," snarled Seth. "I am Gabriel Seth, master of the Flesh Terrors. You state your business to me. This is my area to defend."
The land raider's engines roared. The sighting lasers of machine spirits dotted his armor. Seth's hand went to the handle of the eviscerator maglock to his backpack. He tensed to charge, knowing he could not make the tank before its las cannons blew him apart. Chrismsay whimpered. Electric motor whine harshened the wind. A band of ruby light slit itself across the tank's front, widening as the assault ramp came down. A space marine, almost as big as Seth, strode out into the ecliptic night. His armor was finely wrought, and had many honors painted and engraved into its plates, but all were battered. The gold was knocked from the laurel wreath about his head, the skulls on his elbow guards and knuckles roughened by abrasion. Seth scented the rot of old gore hidden in the crevices of the battle plate as he approached. The warrior halted before Seth. They sized each other up. Violence, a twitch away.
"I brought him like you ask," said Chrismsay.
Seth gave the tribesman a hard look. Seth's face was hidden by his helm, but Chrismsay shrank back from his anger. The knight had scarce little more time for him.
"Silence, wretch. I would not brag of your cunning, lest Seth here think it treachery. He is not known for his forgiving nature."
The Knight of Blood turned his attention to Seth.
"Hail and well met, Flesh Terror, master of the most feared warriors in the Imperium."
The Knight of Blood extended his hand. Seth looked at it. The knight carried himself with exaggerated care. It did not conceal the red heat of firstborn fury radiating from him.
"Almost the most feared," said Seth. "Leave, or your men may take back your body. Give me your name so I can add it to my battle honors."
A hard laugh grated out from the other's voxmeters.
"I am Centaur Jewel, first blade of the Knights of Blood. There, your question is answered. But I will not leave. I will make you. You cannot fight us all, Seth," said Jewel. "Every life is a game of one death. Do you care to bet yours?"
Jewel laughed again.
"Why did you come on foot? Do you have no aerial craft? Why did you land so far from my position?"
countered Seth.
"The reputation of the Flesh Terrors precedes you. I wish to have my warriors ready in case of a less than warm welcome."
"Our reputation?" said Seth. "What of yours?"
"We are kin in many ways. That is why Dante asked us to fight alongside you."
Dante sent you?
Anger curdled Seth's stomach, and he realized there was a weak part of him that hoped Dante was not involved. He was disappointed. This was not betrayal exactly, but Dante should have told him. Seth would have objected, but that was beside the point.
You fight with no one, said Seth. You did not attend the feast. Why should I believe you?
Centaur Jule looked up at Baal. The planet's night side was dark, the false firmament of ship lights bright upon it. The Arx Angelicum was bathed in sunlight on the far side, invisible to them.
We do fight with others. We did not attend the feast. We are unworthy of fellowship. The lure of the Black Rage is too powerful for us, but we will fight alongside you. Is that an insult or a crass attempt at flattery? I fight alongside only those I choose, and I do not choose you. You will. There are very few of you left, I understand. These last decades have been hard on your numbers, even as your reputation crawled back out of the pit of gore your predecessor cast it into. We are the same.
We are not the same, said Seth.
We have few warriors. We have that in common. If we combine our forces, our savagery will become the stuff of legend. The enemy will be here soon. We are coming to your side whether you wish it or not. It has been preordained. You have seen this?
Jule nodded.
It cannot be denied. We are the chosen of Sanguinius. We are blessed with his foresight.
It was Seth's turn to laugh. Jule stared at him.
The chosen of Sanguinius? Arrogance. We believe it to be true, said Jule evenly. They are coming soon. We waited outside the system bounds beyond augur range and slipped in when the shadow grew. We have seen them. You will see, too. They will be here in a few days at the most. We feel them. We feel their hunger.
You can feel them, said Seth, levelly.
I told you, Seth, we are closer to Sanguinius than any other. We have his gifts as well as his curse.
Seth looked at the Knights of Blood. They had a good number of tanks. If they were combined with his own.
No, he said firmly. The flesh tearers fight alone. You fortify, said Jule. This is not your way of battle. I have fought the swarms before. I will harbor our savagery so that it will be best used. You throw yourself into their maws if you wish.
Jule laughed again. His mirth irked Seth.
Tell me of these forts. There are bastions on the wrecks that have survived the ages. I have ordered to rebuild. You know this. You will have spied on me from orbit.
Jule said nothing.
We do not have a space to garrison your warriors, said Seth. Fight elsewhere. Rust and dust has this world in its grip. Has the metal not rotted through?
Asked Jule.
Not all, said Seth. There are defensible positions in these mountains, but not many. The local tribes live in and around them. Against the high fleets, their nature will work against their defense. There are too many tunnels for the enemy to exploit.
Then why stay here? Asked Jule.
That is my concern, said Seth. Move on. Go to Stardam and the Bloodwings. They may welcome you.
You know they will not.
The chapter masters stared at each other for a long moment. Abruptly, Jule broke eye contact and called to Christensay,
Boy, come here!
The tribesman stepped, blinking and afraid, out from Seth's protection.
Do you know the origins of these mountains?
Jule asked him.
They are pretty jewels, stars ripped out of Baalind's necklace, said Christensay, given to Baalind by Baal and broken by their nasty, jealous sister.
Jule gestured at the crumpled masses.
Do you believe this?
It is a story we learn from babehood, said Christensay warily. We tell others, like stories of angels. All is truth.
It is not true, said Jule. Would you like to know the actual truth?
The boy nodded hesitantly. On the eve of an invasion that would destroy his world, but he was still calculating if a good story might buy him a couple of hours by a fire. Seth's scorn increased.
There is a hall I would most dearly love to visit, said the Knight of Blood. Perhaps you can tell me if it still exists.
The Junker fell to his knees.
Yes, Angel, if you say so.
It is the exterior of an old enginarium, though you will not understand that term. A large place, not distorted by the fall of the stars. There is writing there. Show it to me, and I shall tell you the true story of the necklace.
The boy was confused.
I don't understand, Lord Angel.
A place deep under the ground. You call it the Fellholm. To you it is a place of demons and horror, but your ancestors lived there once. Do you know it?
Christensen shook fearfully.
You are wasting your time. The Junker tribes are afraid of the orbital interiors, said Seth. You are wasting my time. I am not. You shall see.
Jewel bent forward so that his breathing grill was level with Christensen's face. The stink of blood coming off him was overpowering. Old and rotten though it was, Seth's mouth watered.
You know the place I speak of, Jewel said in a menacing whisper. You will take us there, or I will kill you.
He did not ask Seth if he wished to attend. Seth growled a warning at this assumption. The knight's presence tugged at his thirst. His fury, never far buried, rose in sympathy to the rage radiated by his distant cousin.
You do not wish to see the history of men on this place, most holy to our shared lord, said the knight. What other tasks detain you? The fortifications. Your men and slaves can do that. When did the mighty Gabriel Seth stoop to dirty his hands with peasant's toil?
Seth stared at the knight. Christensen looked between them nervously.
I will come, said Seth. I do not care for history, but I will not have you lurking under my feet, unseen.
They went back to the mountainous derelicts. This time they went directly inside, following tunnels to the heart of darkness beneath. Once they were past the tangled mess of the northern faces, the ways went straight, bent only slightly by impact and war damage. No natural tunnel could have brought them so far, so quickly. In other respects, the buried corridors and chambers were like natural caverns. Water trickled down the walls into pools where blind things swam. Flying creatures burst from rooms filled with their reeking dung and flew, chittering away. Minerals leached from high above formed organic-looking rills. Seth stopped by one impressive formation, brilliant white streaked with blue oxides in the circle of his suit light. There was plenty of stone used in the construction of the orbital, but he thought the calcium in the rock came from human bones. A hall they passed through 20 minutes later bore out his theory. It was crammed from floor to ceiling with a tangle of remains. Thousands of grey skulls looked out in silent shock. There were other living things down there, humanoid creatures that stared with coldly luminous eyes from the dark, then ran away from the space marines. Christensen was terrified of them, but his fear of Jewel and Seth was greater, and he led them on into the depths of the wrecked orbital. Decay, ruination, death. They seeped into Seth's bones. The necklace was a kingdom of the dead. The remains of ancient times presaged the end come again. Seth felt that in his hearts. There were few obstacles. Christensen evidently knew the route. He took them down random side passages that turned out to bypass crushed arterial ways, or corridors filled in by debris falls or still black lakes. Finally, they emerged into a vast space, so high Seth's luminator beam faded before it reached the ceiling. Jewel made a satisfied noise.
We are here.
A storm of insects rushed from a wall when Seth's light touched them. Christensen cowered.
There are writings here, do you know that?
Said Centaur Jewel. He stepped into the room, hunting for something.
A record of the fall of Old Night and the end of humanity's first stellar empire. I have heard nothing of this, said Seth. The Blood Angels regard themselves as superior to every other chapter of the Blood, said Jewel bitterly. Their librarius holds secrets they would never dream of sharing. Then how do you know? Our founder, Austin Galael, was a native of this moon.
We envy you, primogenitors, for your closeness to the source of our bloodline, but we were lucky enough to be established by captains from the blood angels themselves. Galael had his own records.
The space marines wandered apart, each heading by an intentional degree for different parts of the reactor hall. The floor was soft with guano. No one had come to the cave in a long time. There were signs of ancient occupation. Platforms stepping up one side made the base of a tall ossuary, and the wall was hidden by neatly stacked bones. Seth approached it. The bones were brittle with great age, but the marks of butchery were clear on them. These people had been cannibalized. Jule, meanwhile, had drifted towards the back of the cave. His light fell on jury-rigged catwalks and collapsed shelters made of metal sheeting. The slumped shape of a reactor housing loomed large as the rising barlight moons in front of him. He saw something and made for it in a straight line.
"Here, Lord Seth, come," he beckoned. Seth grumbled in his throat.
Jule waited before a high wall adorned with broken shrines. Something had been written upon the surface. It had long ago corroded away.
"Galael was a considered man like yourself, Lord Seth," said Jule, searching the surface of the wall. "He was a great scholar in his own right, and although he had no psychic ability of his own, the Librarius was always his passion. We have a reputation for savagery, and it is well earned. I speak to you now in calm. But once in combat, we find it impossible to control our passions. The blood angels have their graces and virtues. Once we had a similar system to hold our fury in check. It no longer works. Our wrath at the enemies of mankind grows unchecked, but our Librarius remains important to us, as do histories. There is knowledge of the old times there, gathered from this hall by Galael. Galael's chronicle is at the heart of our collection. In it he wrote extensively of what he learned from his people before time and circumstance separated us from Baal forever."
Jule pointed at the corroded wall.
"The chronicles say that in this place the records of the people were held, engraved into the metal of the fallen stars after the war. They are gone now, but I have longed to look upon the place where they were once displayed, for I know the story they told by heart."
Seth looked over the pitted metal. Fragments of text were visible, curves of letters wrapped around pockmarks or extending from scales of oxidization. Streaks of fossilized fecal matter covered much of the rest. Whatever the words had said was lost to time. Chrismsay looked blankly up at the wall. He was illiterate and lacked the imagination to see anything in the marks, but Jule's words held him spellbound.
"All the worlds in the Red Scar are subject to its humors," said Jule. "To dwell here at all, men must take their elixirs or live burrowed into the ground. That is true of all the planets within 100 light-years of this place, all save Baal. The configuration of the three bodies here deflects the Scar's more terrible radiations. Where men came here in the first great ships, they were as nomads struggling over the desert, and this system was an oasis to them. Baal Primus was gentle enough, but Baal Secundus was a rarer prize yet, an analogue of old Earth and rich in biological diversity."
"And Baal?" asked Seth.
"Baal was, as Baal is," said Jule. "Baal is eternal. The moons were settled. Baal was not at first. For many millennia, the records said the worlds were isolated. The Scar kept them alone. No Xenos civilization or human world was within the range of their ships. Together they developed a culture whose richness was hinted at in these records before they were lost. Galael's chronicle suggests eventually the people of Baal were reunited with the rest of humanity and a golden age beckoned. All this is written in the most perfunctory manner, barely sufficient for context. It is strange, I believe, how people take for granted the norms of their time, never thinking that they will change, and so they leave unrecorded the things that would facilitate understanding of their lives if only they were written down."
Jules' helm moved, his eye lenses glowing in the dark, as if he could read what had once been written on the wall.
"What is recorded in great detail is the manner of the fall.
As war consumed the galaxy, the two moons were isolated again, but though their history was long, their memories were short, and the worlds could not recapture their earlier self-sufficiency. Famine ensued, and Baal Secundus demanded that they, as the more populous world, be granted the protection of the orbital facilities of Baal Primus, and that Baal Primus be evacuated. Baal Primus refused, citing their greater military strength and resources as reasons for their own moon to be protected. The original record was unclear how the war began, but the orbitals were among the first targets. Maybe they were deliberately destroyed. I prefer the theory that an attempt to steal them led to their scuttling, and they fell from the sky, devastating Baal Primus. It is probably not true, but there is a certain amount of poetic hubris there. Ironically, Baal Lind and Baal Fora were safe from the turmoil of the wider galaxy. The Red Scar protected them, as it protected their degenerate descendants until the coming of the Great Angel. In the end, they destroyed each other. This is only legend, said Seth, and it is irrelevant. Do you really think so? Said Jule. In Galil's time, the writing was still readable. I tell you why it is relevant. The terrors of that time came as much from within as without, and this is something all we of Sanguinius's line can understand. We struggle against the monsters of our minds. You, Gabriel Seth, have triumphed. Warriors like you. Jule placed one hand on Seth's shoulder, the other on the back of the neck of Christmasay. You are a lesson to us all in hope. We are all damned, said Seth. The Red Scar brings madness and death to all its worlds, but our fury is holy. He looked down at the Junker. It is Sanguinius's, and all the more powerful. Jule removed his hand from Seth's pauldron and held Chrysumse firmly. The youth moved uncomfortably, but did not dare break free. Not all of us have such fortitude as you, Gabriel Seth. In some of us, the curse is much stronger. Seth's patience was running thin. A waste of time. We are not saved. Our end comes. There. Is that what you wanted to hear? Let me tell you, I will not follow your road. Jule laughed, a single grunt, and closed his fist, crushing the vertebrae in Chrysumse's neck. Incredibly, the boy still lived. Jule hoisted him into the air, vitae running out between his silver fingers. Chrysumse's feet jerked in the air. His tongue, purple with trapped blood, poked stiffly from his mouth. His eyes rolled helplessly. Jule turned his attention upon the youth, watching him die with detached curiosity. These legends hold a lesson for you, Seth. Allies die when they refuse to stand together. Bloodshed is the inevitable outcome. We will fight by your side. We dare not fight alongside any other force, but you flesh terrors are the same as us, pure and strong and wrathful. We will fight with you, whether you want it or not. Seth could have killed him then in the dark, but the Knights of Blood would have attacked the flesh terrors, and two chapters would be lost to the defense in fratricidal squabbles. He growled in frustration. Will you drink with me to seal our pact in blood? Jule held out Chrysumse's corpse to him. I will not, said Seth, even though saliva pooled in his mouth at the rich blood scent rising over the stench of guano. Why not? They are cattle. We are the canids of a herder. Is it not right that we should feed from the herd? He was a wretch, but he did not have to die, said Seth. You should not have killed him. How many similar innocents have your warriors butchered? Not in cold blood, said Seth. This is why you are damned, and I am not. Is it? Said Jule. What was his life? He would have died anyway. His end serves the Emperor better this way. With a tearing wrench, he ripped Chrysumse's head free. Blood ran over his battered gauntlets. Seth's mouth watered all the more. Now will you sup with me? No, said Seth. He clenched his jaw, his angel's teeth extended, and pricked at the soft meat of his inner lip. I will not sup with you. I will not fight with you.
Keep to your own positions. We shall stay on ours. There will be bloodshed if you disagree. Yours will be the first head I take."
Jewel made a disparaging noise.
"If you insist." "Very well. We will venture no closer than 3 miles to your position."
"Too close," said Seth.
"Shall we fight?" said Jewel.
When Seth did not reply, Jewel continued,
"Then we keep to our common enemy. I will see you on the field of battle, Seth, as an ally. I have seen it."
He dropped Chrysomse's mangled corpse and reached for his helm seals.
"Now, please depart. I need to feed, and I prefer to be unobserved."
Seth was only too happy to oblige. Chapter 15. Angelic Sacrifice. Blazing light flooded the throne room. A figure in burnished armor, his features obscured by the glare, stood before the golden throne. Awful machines pounded away in every quarter. Thousands of coffins, wired into the mechanisms, hid untold tales of suffering. The wrongness of the devices gnawed at Dante's soul. In the central throne was a wizened figure for whose benefit this atrocity was committed. Yet he was oblivious to it, as he was to all else on the mortal plane. He sat unmoving as the golden warrior prepared for battle, yet another human life to be sacrificed for the Emperor. Something twisted towards the throne. The golden figure raised his sword. Darkness. Dante's eyes slid open slowly. Disoriented, it took him a second to realize he was in his bedchamber in the Heavenward Redoubt of the Arx Angelicum, and not on Terra. He sat up. The sheets of his huge bed whispered off his skin. An extravagant clock ticked softly at the other side of his bedchamber. Dante had been asleep for 3 hours. Once Dante was capable of fighting for days without rest. Now he took sleep when he could and woke weary from it. If he could, he would have enjoyed the long sleep. Corbulo warned him from the sarcophagi. There were risks for Dante hidden in the holy machines. Age. All down to his damned age. He rested his face in his hands. The texture of his wrinkled skin disturbed him, for a dreaming man never sees himself old. He remained that way for several minutes, breathing slowly, until the air passing in and out of his lungs absorbed his attention and calmed him. With a quick, decisive breath, he threw back the covers and rose from his bed. His muscles ached, an old man's pains afflicting an immortal. Rotations of his shoulders worked out some of the stiffness, but by no means all. He thought to call for his equerry. Arafeo's name died on his lips. The man was gone. Aged from youth to senescence in what seemed to be minutes to Dante. He had put off appointing a new equerry from the blood thralls. There had not seemed to be much point. He dressed in a robe stiff with embroidered angels and fetched himself a cup of wine laced with blood, as was the custom of the blood angels. Unremarkable, save that Dante had eschewed the drinking of blood for long centuries, until these last months. Dante swirled the wine around the goblet beneath his nose, allowing the scent of spices and vitae to stir his sluggish hearts. He shut his eyes to savor it. The smell of blood. The smell of life. He had had the dream of the Golden Warrior many times. Whether it was a genuine vision, he could not tell. Dante kept the dream to himself, knowing that its recurrence would be seen as egocentricity on his part. This need for the figure to be him, for him to have one truly worthy deed to do before his life was done, it was a weakness, and he did not care to share that. He was amused by how much he tried to convince himself he was the warrior. He had never seen the face, though from the form of the armor the figure was a space marine and not a mortal or a member of the Adeptus Custodes. Did he see wings? He discounted them. If it were Dante, where was his axe? Well, Dante theorized, he might have lost it. Besides, visions were figurative, not literal. Unfortunately, they shared that characteristic with dreams. He smiled at his conceit that he would save the Emperor. While this desire he had was undoubtedly indulgent, he needed it. He needed a reason to continue, to fight the daily woe and exhaustion his position burdened him with. If there was harm in that, it was no great one. Today was different. He mulled it over as he sipped his wine, puzzled. One detail of the vision had changed. Each time when he had seen the Golden Warrior, the Emperor's sword was upon his unmoving knee, as it had reputedly been for 10 millennia. That last time, it was missing. He feared that to be a bad omen. Almost in confirmation of his misgivings, a bell tolled in the distance. His head came up suddenly. The sound drifted from hearing and back, inaudible in that deeply buried room, to all but a space marine's ears. He strode from his bedchamber, bursting through double ebony doors into his private dining room. His feet padded over mosaics of carnelian, all the detail given in different shades of red. The tolling bell grew louder as he marched to the glass doors leading onto his balcony and went out into the Well of Angels. The deep throat of the volcano plunged away. Graceful patterns of lumen light illuminated the plaza thousands of feet below. The moist scents of the Verdis Elysia drifted up from broad terraces. The well was a place of peace until the bell of war rang. It resounded loudly round the shaft. From high above, a wild howling competed with a stately tolling. Dante raised his eyes to the oval of lilac morning sky trapped by the Arc's Murus. Towers pointed upward like teeth. One in particular drew his gaze. The inmates of Amareo were awake, all of them baying and shrieking for blood, their monstrous cries sounding throughout the fortress monastery. Their howls were a sure sign war was upon them. Dante hurried back inside to a hard-lined vox panel set into the far wall. A knock stopped him before he reached it. "Enter," he called. Sanguinary guard opened carved doors of anthracite. Beyond lay his staterooms, banqueting hall, armory, private chapel, and other chambers of his palace. Captain Borgio stood in the doorway, armored for battle. "Borgio, the damned scream for blood. It has begun, has it not?" Borgio nodded. "My lord, I have urgent communication from the picket fleets. Our long-range auger boys have been tripped across multiple Corwood sectors." Borgio looked almost apologetic as he delivered the news. "The Tyranids are here." Fully armed and armored, Dante marched towards the Basilica Sanguinarum, the full strength of his sanguinary guard flanking him. Music did its best to conceal the snarling and anguished shouts of those in the grip of the first rising from the cathedral, but it could not. Nothing could, not the mass, chanted repetition of the Moripatris as the signs of Sanguinius knelt in prayer to stave off madness, or the clamorous peals shaking the fortress. The bell in the Citadel Reclusium had been joined by others. They would not cease ringing until the invasion began. The Arx Angelicum was frantic with activity. There were not sufficient holy spaces for all the space marines in the Basilica, so the Brothers of the Blood knelt in groups wherever they could find space. Under the solemn guidance of their chaplains, they prayed for mastery over the Black Rage. The stirrings of the First had come upon them unexpectedly with the arrival of the High Fleet. Blood thralls ran about everywhere, preparing for imminent attack. Only the servitors seemed unhurried, but the sheer numbers of them clumping about betrayed the gravity of the situation.
"Make way! Make way!" shouted Sepharan. "Make way!"
None had difficulty obeying the order. The corridors were cleared instantly, allowing Dante's party to tramp by. At the gates of the Basilica Sanguinarum, various dignitaries awaited the commander. They too parted, all but one. Chaptermaster Geron of the Angels Numinous stood alone before the giant gates. He held his helmet clamped under one arm. His face was pale and contorted with fury.
"Stand aside, Master Geron," said Sepharan. "The commander will pass."
"No,"
said Geron, stiffly shaking his head.
"Stand aside," commanded Sepharan.
The sanguinary guard raised their Angelus bolt guns.
"You threaten me," said Geron in astonishment, "when you allow this abomination."
He pointed behind him to the gates. From inside came the roaring and pitiful shouting of space marines in the grip of the Black Rage.
"You treat them to this honor. The fallen should be incarcerated in the Tabernacle of Repentance. They must undergo the shriving before they are expended. They shame us all with their weakness."
His features quivered with emotion.
"An angel should be pure and noble, These mindless brutes are an embarrassment. Stand aside, demanded Sepharin. You will not be asked again.
Dante stepped forward and rested a calming hand on Sepharin's arm. Geron, he said, while your warriors fight for me, all will be accorded the same respect as the brothers in my chapter. Ordmael spoke up from his position by the gates.
They are blessed in this moment with Sanguinius's vision. They are cursed and unclean, said Geron, rounding on the chaplain. I will not have this.
You granted me command, said Dante. Make any attempt to remove your warriors from the basilica, and I will kill you myself. Do you really wish to plunge our brotherhood into war as the great devourer bears down on us? Show pity to your men. They are your brothers yet. Geron snarled. Dante's sanguinary guard interposed themselves between the two chapter masters. Geron made to move forward, but his own sanguinary high priest stepped to his side and firmly took his elbow.
It goes against our beliefs, my brother, he said, low and urgently. But now is not the time.
Geron gave Dante a look of pure fury.
I should have expected no less from you, Dante, who openly consorts with knights of blood and invites the savage Gabriel Seth into his confidence. You stand shoulder to shoulder with those who would embrace the rage.
He spat on the floor. The marble sizzled with the acid in his spittle.
You will obey me, said Dante. Stand aside. For honor's sake I will obey, as I voted to obey, said Geron.
He pointed at Dante.
But I will not forget this slight.
Geron's priest moved him to the side.
Pray open the gates, boomed Sepharin.
The Basilica Sanguinarum's high portal creaked open, letting out the full volume of the howling of the damned. Space marines of many chapters were still being brought into the cathedral as Dante entered. Some arrived in a state of calm, glazed confusion, or were brought in unconscious. Others needed to be wrestled into place.
This is all of them? Asked Dante of Ordemail. The Moripaltris continues, my lord, but new incidences of rage are tailing away. This will be the majority.
Major conflict was always presaged by the awakening of the prisoners of the Tower of Amareo. That such debased beasts should be so close to Sanguinius frankly horrified Dante, but by dint of their hyperactive gene seed, their sixth sense was sharper even than that of the librarians, and their rage the first to kindle. When war spread its red wings, the prisoners of Amareo heralded it. If the Amareans awoke and bayed for living flesh, the Blood Angels knew to expect their own visions. They prepared themselves as best they could, steeled for the ritual of Moripatris, for the memories of Sanguinius intruded strongly when the Amareans sang. In those times, it was certain that several of their number would succumb to the black rage and be lost. Only this time it was not several who had fallen. It was not dozens, as the worst crises could precipitate. It was hundreds, far too many to be contained in the chapels used for the purpose of blessing the damned. The cathedral was full of afflicted brothers from every chapter. From differing brotherhoods in life, in their living death, they found a common hell. Their armor was black and crossed with red saltiers, with little but their badges to show from which chapter they hailed. It was a sorrowful spectacle of unity that brought the magnitude of the curse home to all who saw it. The damned behaved according to their character. Some struggled too violently to be armored and knelt naked on the stone. Others were sunk deep into trances or prayer. The tranquil yet authoritative words of 24 chaplains calmed others. The states of many were not constant, but shifted from one mode of behavior to another as their self-control waxed and waned, and so more than half were restrained by heavy chains about the wrists, ankles, and necks. Dante took his position at the head of the basilica beneath the statue of Sanguinius. Ordemail began his shouted oratory as soon as he was in position. There was little ceremony to the ritual. The nature of the congregation demanded it be concluded swiftly.
May Sanguinius watch over you as you enter the last trial of your life, began Ordemail. May the Emperor use you while your arms remain strong. May your fury fire you as you fight your last.
Ordemail intoned the prayer loudly. Calming choral music softened the atmosphere, leaching away thoughts of blood and replacing them with contemplative sorrow. Gradually, the swollen death company became quiet, as deeply embedded hypno-indoctrination was called into activation by the words. It was potent, but it would not last. Serfs from various chapters came out from hiding in the cathedral aisle and moved swiftly among the damned, affixing death ribbons to newly repainted armor.
"In the name of humanity, do you tread the dark road to redemption?" continued Ordemail. "And as your enemies flee from your righteous wrath, shall you find peace in death?"
The most violent battle brothers were quiescent now, and could be approached with minimum risk. Well-practiced hands undid chains, quickly completing arming rituals, while the death company were lulled by the litany of doom.
"By your deeds shall ye be known, by your rage shall you forge your deeds."
Other prayers were whispered by other chaplains. Ordemail was not the most senior chaplain in the host. There were over a dozen reclusiarchs at Baal alone, but the others deferred to his authority as highest-ranking Blood Angels chaplain. He was the Paternus Sanguis, master of the Tower of Amareo. The title carried great weight. The serfs and thralls withdrew as quickly as they emerged from their hiding places. The chaplains began to rouse their charges, unlocking their chains from the floor and bidding them get to their feet.
"In blood there is life," said Ordemail, reaching the last stanza. "In life there is thirst for blood. In death the thirst dies. Sanguineus be with us as he is with you."
The prayer varied between chapters. The sentiments were the same. Specially adapted servitors came to the aid of the chaplains, strong enough to restrain the damned should they go berserk, expendable enough that it did not matter if they failed. Ordemail beckoned to his peers. At the rear of the cathedral, the three rage gates opened onto large lifter cages, ready to convey the damned to the chambers in the dungeons of Amareo, where they would be housed until needed. Dante bowed his head in respect as they filed out. The damned were soothed by their chaplains, though they were already growing restive again. Dante wondered for a moment what Lamartes might do with such a force, but Lamartes was at Diamore, light years away. The last of the damned was shepherded into the lifters, and his chains secured in place on the wall. The more aggressive were beginning to shout again, uttering heartbreaking words first spoken 10 millennia ago, and repeated many times since.
"Why?" one demanded to know. "Why did you betray us, Horus?"
The gate slammed shut, cutting off his question. There was no answer to give. Chapter 16. Void War. Situated beneath the Citadel Reclusium at the top of the Heavenward Redoubt was the prime strategium of the Blood Angels. Pale red sunlight filtered through armor-glass windows 20 feet thick. Wide horizontal slits cut through the rock on the other side of the glass gave sweeping views out of both sides into the desert and the plunging well of angels. Several hundred people were present, and a tense hush was upon them. Servitors, mortals, and space marines were engaged in duties that could decide the fate not only of Baal and the Blood Angels, but of the segmentum beyond. Each piece of the war machine was as vital as the next, whether human thrall, cogitator subarray, or decorated captain of the Adeptus Astartes. Commander Dante understood that better than most. Under his purview, they operated excellently. A dozen separate command stations, individually tasked with overseeing an aspect of Baal's defense, were situated around the central hololithic tacticarium. About its eerie projection sphere were gathered a band of heroes of rare renown. Many were regarded as the epitome of imperial virtue in their own right, but even these great warriors waited upon Commander Dante's word. Dante stood upon a raised platform, his eyes trained on the projection along with everyone else's. The sphere depicted the Baal system, the Red Star Baelor and its worlds, the triplets of the Baalite subsystem, the solitary gas giant Set, the clumped asteroid field that separated outer and inner system, and the cold, distant world of Amer, alone on its 600-year journey around the star. Baelor was not a fruitful sun. It had few children.
"Expand the field of observation," said Dante. "Show me the outer bonds."
A quiet whir of lenses pulled back the view. Baelor shrank to the size of a pomegranate. Baal and its moons were bright dots circling each other. The other worlds glinted. Only gaseous Set was big enough to see as more than a point of light. Far out at the edge of the projection field, where the image began to lose integrity and focus, was Baelor's cometary belt depicted on the hololith as a swarm of tiny dots moving with the agitation of bacilli in a drop of water. Just inside this ultimate shell of the system was the Space Marine fleet, the assembled navies of nigh 70 chapters divided into 4 battle groups. They waited at a distance from one another. The direction of the Tyranid's fleet approach was known. Where exactly it would breach the cometary wall was not. On a human scale, the ships of the Imperium were colossi, miles-long chunks of metal as large as cities, home to tens of thousands of cyborgs, thralls, and space marines. In the vastness of space, they were specks. Shifting shoals of data tags displayed their position. By Dante's left shoulder stood the Master of Interpretations, the blood thrall liaison with the astropaths of the chapter. Vox signals would take hours to reach the fleet. By the power of ancient science, hololithic communication was instantaneous across in-system distances, but fragile in the face of the shadow in the warp. The astropaths would be the last line of communication with the fleets, but all means, electronic or immaterial, were vulnerable to the Tyranids. An earthquake rumbled through Baal, upsetting the projection. The Arx Angelicum stone moaned.
"They are close," said Captain Essus of the Bloodswords. "They trouble Baal. This is the sign of their coming, the gravitic pulse."
"What of the warp?" asked Dante quietly.
"The shadow is stronger, but our astropaths are still in contact with the fleet, my lord," said the Master of Interpretations.
"When will they come?" asked Geron.
His tension spoke for them all. No one replied. All of them remained focused on the hololith. Dante had set his pieces on the board. 21 battle barges, 94 strike cruisers, and several hundred smaller craft would intercept the High Fleet under the command of Bellerophon aboard the Blade of Vengeance. They would strike, cripple as many large vessels as they could, then fall back to Baal. 6,000 space marines were aboard those fleets. 12,000 were on Baal, 6,000 on Baal Secundus, and 5,000 on Baal Primus. They were the largest gathering of the blood since the Horus Heresy. Time would tell if it would be enough. They stood for hours staring at the hololith. It was almost a relief when the first blinking red dot of enemy contact sprang into life at the edge of the system.
"They have come," said Dante.
A choir of thralls began the psalm protective against planetary investment. The lights changed. Threat indicators ratcheted up from null to beta severe. The first red dot was alone for but a moment. Hundreds more began to blink across a wide segment of Baal's system edge. Many were feeder scouts, the solitary eyes of the High Fleet. Several proved to be the tips of attack tendrils. Behind them came long, sinuous ribbons of other dots, questing for prey. They were forming up across a band of space, little over a single astronomical unit wide. Already, the Space Marine fleets were maneuvering to counter. Giant machines within the Arx Murus growled, pushing up huge blocks of stone into the window slots. The room shook with the effort of moving so many thousand tons of rock. The red light of Baelor became a silver fine as a diffuse lasbeam. Emergency lumens crackled on. Machine lights were stars in the gloom.
"We are at war," said Dante.
Erwin sat on the edge of his command throne, unblinkingly staring out of the oculus at the splendid pinion. Other ships of his chapter waited with him, their bristling weapons casting black shadows on their sides in the starshine of distant Baelor. The glow from the red star was almost as bright as the sun that far out. Erwin hated looking into it. It was like gazing at a suppurating wound, but still he could not tear himself away.
"Any sign yet?"
"None, as there was none 3 minutes ago when you asked, Captain," said Ackerman. The serviles were glad he answered. None of them liked to speak with a captain before battle, not even the 5 battle brothers of Ackerman's squad stationed as guards on the deck. Erwin snarled.
"All this damn waiting. Where are they?"
His thirst teased him, fueling his frustration so that his skin crawled under his body glove. His fist tensed so hard, his armored fingertips pushed in the metal ribbing covering his palm.
"Damn them," he said. "Damn them."
He was panting quickly and shallowly. He could sense the thirst of the others on the ship and vessels around him. Battle hunger was the worst form of starvation.
"They will be here soon enough, brother," said Ackerman.
"Do not patronize me, First Sergeant," snapped Erwin. "You feel the same wrath as I."
"Perhaps," said Ackerman. "But I control it better."
Erwin's head whipped round at this impudence. He bared Angel's teeth already at full extension.
"My lords," the servile of the watch spoke up,
I have hundreds of incoming contacts. Toxins sounded. On the tactical displays of the command deck, a swarm of red lights made itself known. Revision, there are thousands, said the servile of the watch. Tens of thousands. Irwin leaned forward. Nothing was visible in the oculus, only the vileness of the scar and the occasional glint of a comet turning about its axis. How fast? Asked Irwin. Super light speed, my lord, said the servile. My augurs show massive gravitic disturbances at several distinct points.
Adjust orientation towards the nearest, said Irwin.
Adjusting, said the servile of the helm. As the servile spoke these words, Irwin witnessed a rippling of the view forward, the bending of light due to manipulation of gravity. Something was hiding behind the distortion.
There they are, said Irwin. There they are. All vessels of the Angels Excelsis, prepare for battle.
Irwin snorted. Folodark had never been one to make grandiose speeches. The rippling cut out. For a moment the oculus was full of streaks. These compressed themselves into the solid shape of Tyranid bioships that shone wetly with deep space ice. Small, teardrop-shaped vessels, bristling with sensor spines, were breaking from the fore, heading back towards the shelter of the vessels coming behind. Irwin laughed savagely and hammered his hand onto the lion's head of his throne arm. Untold thousands of ships were ahead of him. Green glows lit up behind them as they engaged bioplasma drives and advanced towards Baal. The box came alive with orders flying between dozens of ships.
Attack!
Commanded Folodark. The splendid pinion lurched as its engine stack burned full ahead.
At last, grinned Irwin. A worthy foe.
Aboard the Blade of Vengeance, Bellerophon oversaw the unfolding void war through the ship's vast main hololith.
Angels Vermilion Interdiction Force, commanded Bellerophon. Come about and bring weapons to bear on advancing Tendril 12 Alpha.
The tactical displays of the Blade of Vengeance were a maddening blur of vessels. Bellerophon squinted at them in turn. The four battle groups had performed to their plan, coming together as a square, their squadrons of ships forming towers of a vertical castle. Smaller groups split off from the main, darting out into the onrushing swarm to destroy prime targets and sow disruption among the invaders through boarding actions and rapid torpedo strikes. This tactic still had its value, though it was no longer as efficacious as it had been. The Tyranids had identified the ploy some years ago and adapted their command net, spreading backup synaptic nodes to lesser ships. Discovering which housed them was a mixture of careful observation and Emperor-guided guesswork. The Blade of Vengeance flew in tandem with its sister, the Bloodcaller. Together, they put out a tremendous amount of fire. Within half an hour of them encountering the lead elements of Leviathan, space was full of broken shell fragments and giant chunks of flesh. Frozen body fluids drifted in clouds between the corpses of bioships. But for every ship destroyed, there were two dozen more to take its place. The greatest of the living vessels were truly titanic, dwarfing even the battle barges. Vast and slug-like, the Norn ships were encrusted in ancient ice and stolen asteroids, glued together with excreted resins that was as good as any armor. The Hive ships had no energy fields, but protected inside their jackets of stone and frost, they sailed through the full fire of Imperial vessels with little ill effect. One lay ahead. The Blade of Vengeance plowed through dozens of smaller vessels in an attempt to intercept it before it broke through the fleet of the Golden Suns. Toxins and alarms chimed, rang, beeped, and shouted. Though the Tyranids' weaponry was less potent than that of the Imperium, they had a lot more of it. The void shields flexed and thrummed to the impact of torpedo spines and living missiles. Fast hunter beasts streaked past on the green fires of bioplasmic jets, spitting barbed quills from dripping orifices. Convulsing tubes raged down the sides of the largest ships, cast out giant gnarled teeth by peristaltic motion that burst on hulls to unleash hordes of metal-hungry creatures. But in the main, the Tyranids neglected ranged combat. Giant nautiloids vented glittering clouds of gas, moving with deceptive slowness towards the Imperial battle line, their 500-yard-long tentacles extended to entrap ships. They seemed so cumbersome, but when close, sinews snapped out with such force the tentacles buried themselves in plasteel, and the Space Marine ships were reeled in, their void shields useless. Bellerophon watched as one of the Blade of Vengeance's escorts was caught. It bucked in the fleshy snare, engines blazing. But it was doomed, engulfed by dozens more tentacles, and broken in two. The variety of vessels beggared belief. Some were like slugs, others looked like void whales. There were examples that bore a passing resemblance to sea creatures, scaled up a million times. There were ships with massive blades at the front, or armored beaks. Ships with tentacles predominated, but others had horned rams for prows, or carried supersized versions of biocannons wielded by the Carnifexes or Turdigons fixed in giant, never-closing maws. There were ships with flippers, ships with tails, ships with atrophied arms and legs. Many had monstrously long tails. Some were armored with a segmented chitinous plate common to most tyrannid organisms, albeit on a massive scale. Others seemed to have no protection other than a leathery hide. Every possible permutation of life was there, but all melded, changed, bent to the hive mind will. In the diversity was an awful uniformity.
"Brother," said Asante from the command throne, "we will have to move position. There are multiple attack craft on an intercept course."
Bellerophon spared a glance for a side screen where Asante cast the relevant data.
"One more moment, Asante, one more! The hive ship! The hive ship!"
Bellerophon nodded absently, only a fragment of his mind on the conversation. His face flickered with the light of a dozen tactical displays. His enhanced space marine mind took hundreds of different pieces of information and translated them into a battle plan.
"It is our primary target at this time. We take that out, this entire sub-tendril will collapse."
Power feedback from the stressed void shields shook the ship stem to stern.
"Very well," said Asante, "but I'm pulling up and out of this maelstrom as soon as it is dead."
Bellerophon signaled the Blood Angels' battle group.
"Prepare for attack run."
The Blade of Vengeance groaned as engines forced it down. The hive ship loomed ahead. It was a true leviathan of the void, 20 miles long and 3 across. Impacts flared all over its shell. 4 strike cruisers harried it, all aiming for the front. Bellerophon could not bring himself to call it a prow. At the base of 2 vast mandibles, spread wide like shears, was a cluster of red-brown eyes and a tiny tentacled mouth.
"Charge lances!" ordered Asante. "Load cyclonic torpedoes. Main guns, keep our flanks clear."
Bellerophon spent an intense half-minute rearranging the Blade of Vengeance's support ships. Flights of interceptors flew around the group, doing their best to clear away the teeming swarms of Tyranid fighter beasts. Swift destroyers identified and disabled approaching Kraken ships with volleys of torpedoes. The 4 cruisers zeroed in on their target, hammering away at the creature's face. The angles were awkward, and many shots were simply snatched from the void by the thing's lightning-fast feeder tentacles.
"Let us lance this thing in its vile Xenos face, then break off," said Bellerophon.
"As you command, Lord of the Heaven Gate," said Asante.
"Cruisers, stand clear," ordered Bellerophon. "Targets locked," reported Asante's gunnery master. "Fire," said Asante.
The Blade of Vengeance spat out a full spread of torpedoes, turning slightly once they were away to glide cleanly abeam the hive ship. As it passed the living battleship, 4 pillars of blinding light slammed out from the Blade of Vengeance's dorsal turrets, blasting the hive ship's head to pieces. The weapons snapped off, leaving the hive ship dying. Thick blood spewed from the front. The torpedoes smashed home as the Blade of Vengeance and its escorts moved upward over the hive ship. Atomic fire annihilated the first 3 miles of its forequarters. The symbiotic weapons creatures were still firing, but the core of the hive ship was dead. Random eructations of gas spasmed from its thruster spiracles, and it lumbered out of formation, smashing aside dozens of its fellows. Beyond the dead hive ship, the void was packed with uncountable enemy vessels.
"One down, 50,000 to go," said Asante dryly. "Hold formation!"
Polodark's simple command cut through the alarms, clanging repetitively all around Irwin. He would need luck to restore order to the Angels' Excelsis fleet, whose battle order was being split apart by repeated suicidal attacks towards their center. The responses of Irwin's fellow captains were garbled nonsense in his vox beads. The Angels' Excelsis were under massive attack. granted the honor of sallying out from the mobile fortresses of the main battle group, they dipped in and out of the onrushing swarms like a rapier. But repeated thrusts had blunted their point. The quick attack and withdrawal that bought them many good ship kills earlier in the battle was confounded by the destiny of bioships streaming past them towards Baal. The Space Marines had been pushed further and further back across the system. 3 days of fighting saw them lose hundreds of millions of miles of ground. Large tendrils of the Hive had twisted away towards Set and Amer and were greedily devouring the resources of the worlds. If there was one comfort to be taken from this difficult battle, it was this. The Tyranids had been so starved in the Red Scar that they were consuming worlds with little to no complex organics, worlds they bypassed when the hunting was good. The swarms flowed over and around the Space Marines like a mountain river around boulders. There were not enough Imperial ships to stop the flow. Little islands of violence were all they could manage. Ships came at the Angels Excelsis from every direction. Sprays of penetrative spines burst into flares of light against the splendid pinions' void shields. "They are coming in for another pass!" shouted the servile of the watch.
"Intensify forward fire!" Erwin commanded.
"Yes, my lord!" responded the servile belligerent. The oculus flickered like a primitive imaging device. Thousands of autocannon rounds from point defense turrets slammed into the waves of spine torpedoes hurtling towards them. Leech-like boarding craft, twisting their way through the bombardment, disintegrated under intense fusion fire. Spores were obliterated by the thousand.
"I've seen thinner blizzards," growled Erwin.
Half the Angels Excelsis ships were lost. The panicked cries of serviles screamed out of the box as the Angelic died. Its sides were riddled with the maggot holes of Tyranid boarding worms. Its guns were silent. The questing arms of a vast Kraken ship wrapped themselves about the Angelic's midsection, pulling it inexorably towards the grinding bone plates of the bioship's maw. Erwin threw up his hand to shield his eyes against a reactor death that didn't come. The Angelic was sawn in half and pulled inwards. The sight of its prow and stern rubbing against each other was obscene somehow. Even the gas vented from its emptied compartments was inhaled by the gigantic creature. It consumed the entire thing, meat, metal, men, and monster. Not a scrap escaped. Volodark was on the Vox, hollering orders. On a short-range hololithic tactical projection, the full enormity of the situation was plain. The Essence Eternal, the chapter flagship, was in trouble. Three lesser Kraken ships had their boneless arms entwined about the chapter battle barge's superstructure. One Kraken came away, its shell burning ferociously, eviscerated by a broadside. It would not be enough to save the Essence Eternal. Many limbed spores were clamped like tubes.